Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thanks a lot, everybody, for joining us here this fine Sunday afternoon. As a reminder for those that are with us live, if you're on the show page, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom. You'll find the chat room there. It's a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. We already got a good gaggle there from Claude, Lucian, and the rest of the crew. If you have some observations or some questions that you would like to address to us, that's a great place to do it because both of us will be monitoring that as we go through. And if we get a question that's better and smarter than ours, then we'll pick it up and try to fold it in as we go along. And if you're new to Midrats or you just want to catch up with some shows you may have missed, you can always get the full archive over Blog Talk Radio, or you can go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. And in an information-driven society where we have a 24-hour news cycle and everybody is trying to get the latest and the most, what is the mission responsibility and the primary responsibilities of those in the Navy who are the interface between the press, the taxpayer, the international community, and Navy leadership, whether in uniform or civilian? Our guest for the first half of the hour is probably the best person we can have on board to help address that, is the Chief of Information, Rear Admiral John Kirby, United States Navy. And for the second half of the show, we're going to have returning guest Major Peter J. Munson, United States Marine Corps. He's the editor of Small Wars Journal, Middle East expert, and author of a new book, War, Warfare, Democracy, Rethinking America's Quest for the End of History. It's a sobering view of how we got where we are, the underlying trends that we're going to have that's going to impact us for the rest of the half century. But now let's get on to our first guest, Rear Admiral Kirby. Welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I'm real excited about this.
Well, great to have you as well, sir. Just kind of set the framework here. Most of our listeners have a good idea who a public affairs officer is, the PAO they run into and they see written about all the time. And many have a vague idea of who the Chief of Information, CHINFO, is. But just take a minute to explain for the listeners, what is your primary role and responsibility as CHINFO, and what is your relationship to the constellation of public affairs officers that people may run into?
It's a great question. I think I view my primary role as the Chief of Information is to be the Navy's spokesman, sort of the corporate spokesman for the entire Department of the Navy. I work for the Secretary of the Navy and for the CNO, but I represent the department, the Navy Department, publicly. So I consider myself very much the voice of the Navy, and I take that responsibility real seriously. And my sort of another role, and I hate to say secondary role because it's equally important in my mind, is to be the community manager, the head PAO for all the 1650s. That's our designator in the Navy, 1650, for all the PAOs in the Navy. So I am very involved in their growth and development, their training and education. I get very involved in their detailing and their in the assignments that they go to next and their own growth and development. So I kind of look at it twofold, and I try to spend as much time as I can in both those camps.
And along the same lines, you mentioned how you had the PAOs are kind of underneath you, but when people look at other communities, you know, service warfare officers, they're up on a ship, and aviators are all in squadrons, but PAOs, they're spread around, they're onesies and twosies here and there. What type of role do you have in trying to get a certain sense of unified direction, standardization, and the ability of POs to interface and utilize their peers to get best practices and try to work together as a cohesive unit.
That's a big deal to me, Sal. One of the things that I think we can improve upon in our community is a mentoring culture. You know, we have this reputation because we're the smallest community in the Navy. There's only roughly 230 Navy public affairs officers worldwide. And as you said very, very accurately, we're sort of onesie-twosies. We're kind of spread out except for on major staffs. Sometimes the PAO, many times in fact, is the only PAO at a command. And we're far flung. And we have this reputation because we're so small of being terrific mentors to one another. And I think there's a lot of mentoring going on and a lot of connective tissue, but I don't think it's as good as we think it is. And we've done a little polling recently. We did a mentoring survey I asked to get done a couple months ago. And, you know, roughly in total, just over half Navy public affairs officers believe that top leadership in our community is dedicated to mentoring. So that's really not a great number, and I'd like to see it get up there. So I have been focusing a lot in the last few months on trying to help encourage that connective tissue that I talk about. I sent out an email to the whole community, which I do frequently. A recent one was entitled, "Who Else?" In other words, who else are you asking for advice? Who else do you know may have gone through a similar event? Maybe you're being tasked by your boss with a ship decommissioning ceremony and you've never done one before. Well, find out what other PAOs out there, and there's a lot of them, who have done those kinds of things. Reach out, find out what the lessons learned are. We can do this because we're so small, informally. We don't need a formal mentoring program. We just need to be able to reach out and touch one another, and we can, because many of us know each other very, very well.
Well, Admiral, how does a typical outstanding young service warfare officer decide to go into the public affairs world, and what's the track that officer can follow?
Well, we welcome lateral transfers from the other communities. In fact, most of our junior officers come from other communities as what we call lateral transfers. I was one of those. I was a surface warfare officer and became a public affairs officer during my second tour in the Navy, my first shore tour. We have a lateral transfer board that meets every year to examine the records of officers who desire to become public affairs officers. Typically, when a young officer is going to lateral transfer, they put down on their application sort of three communities that they would like to join first, second, and third in terms of preference. Obviously, we like to see public affairs as the number one, but that doesn't mean that somebody who doesn't pick it as their number two choice doesn't sometimes get into the service or into our community as well. But we look, just like every other community, we look for sustained superior performance, good fitness reports, a level of maturity, certainly a background, doesn't have to be, but a background in journalism, communications, English, that kind of thing helps. But believe me, we take officers into the community with engineering and science backgrounds and degrees that don't necessarily work in the world of words the way we do, but it's certainly that's something we look at. For me, it was quite by accident. I mean, I'll just admit to your entire audience, I was at best a mediocre surface warfare officer. I was not great at this. I had screened for department head school, and so I was on my way in the surface community, teaching at the Naval Academy, teaching history and navigation. My background is in history, and looking for something else to do in the Navy. And a friend of mine, Jamie Graybill, who's now a retired captain, PAO, we both knew that we wanted to do something different. It wasn't that we didn't like surface warfare. We just wanted to do something different. And we quite by accident fell into public affairs as a career choice. And both of us ended up loving it and, of course, making careers out of it.
Admiral, one thing we've seen in the decade plus of war that we've been in, you know, different communities and different services as a result have learned and changed and adjusted. The medical community has learned how to operate differently, have different specialties, different abilities to deploy. The CBs have expanded in their capabilities. The EDO community obviously has been very heavily changed. And even your standard issue warfare communities, from Army infantry to naval tactical aviation, have had to look at what the demands are and have learned to adjust it and get their training right and their procedures differently. When you look back at where the PAO community was 10, 11 years ago and where they are right now, how has the last decade of war changed your community and how you operate?
It's changed us fundamentally. It is your question is the question that we are all still grappling with, probably the most important thing that we all have to consider, and it's something I spent a lot of time thinking about. I'll give you the abbreviated version of a stump speech that I like to give about the four new worlds we're all living in. And I say four new worlds because there's essentially four stakeholders in the communication process. And I'm speaking about the public communication process. There's the commander, there's the public, there's the press, and of course there's the public affairs officer, the PAOs. We're all living in a different world here thanks to the ubiquitousness of and pervasiveness of information. And the participatory culture that we are now living in. People don't just want to be talked to; they want you to talk with them. So the audience, the public, I think they live in what I call a post-audience world. It used to be that when I came into public affairs office, when I became a PAO in the early 90s, the communication process was very much like a college lecture. You develop your themes, your messages, your talking points, if you will, your lecture, and then you find a way to deliver that upon an audience. And maybe if you got time, you take a couple of questions and you exit stage right. Well, now it's like a college keg party. Everybody's in the room together. Everybody's talking, sometimes shouting at one another. Everybody wants to be heard, and everybody wants to speak. It's very participatory. It's very democratic. It's very flat, to use the phrase from Tom Friedman. And we've got to get used to that. We have to learn to be at that party and how to be not just heard, but how to listen. This is the other thing I'm stressing a lot with public affairs officers. We've got to listen. We have to provide feedback mechanisms for people to talk back to us. So social media is a terrific tool for that, and we try to be very interactive in the Navy in our social media environment. But frankly, we've got to be interactive in every other way. I tell flag officers all the time, don't just go to give a speech. Make sure you leave time for questions and stay a little late after the event and work the tables a little bit, work the room, talk to people, let them approach you, collect business cards, make contacts. The commanders are living in what I call a post-interview world. They can't just think about public affairs anymore as sitting down with a reporter, taking questions, and again, walking out of the room and being done with it. They've got to develop relationships with the press and with public groups, with people, with local community leaders, and relationships are built, as you guys very well know, and you're in the world that you're living in, they're built on give and take. The PAOs, I think we're living in a post-clandestine world. Very little happens anymore that doesn't get out there. As 4 years with Admiral Mullen on the Joint Staff, I started out my first year being just amazed at how much stuff was finding its way onto the pages of the New York Times that might have been in a classified briefing just the day before. Now I'm not quite so amazed by that. I try to live in that environment, make sure that I know what's going on and what leaders are thinking about, what decisions are about to get made, so that I can get ahead of it should it break out in the press. And frequently, it often does. And let me just I don't mean to belabor my answer, but to the media, I think the press are living in a post-message world. And what I mean by that is they're tired of just hearing us give our top-line points to them. Maybe they always were, but I can tell you that working with the Pentagon Press Corps every day, and it's been my great delight to do so, what they want is context. What they want is understanding. They want to know what's behind the decisions we're making. Why are we doing it? Why now? What does it mean? And we've got to provide, PAOs have got to be willing to go on background, if need be, and provide that context and that greater level of understanding. We've got to get beyond the talking point level. Yeah, everybody needs public affairs plans, and everybody needs themes and messages. I got that. And we're still going to write those plans, and we're still going to develop those talking points. But if we aren't willing to go deeper, then we're failing in doing our essential mission, which I believe is to explain ourselves to the American people. Sorry, that was a long answer, but you really hit on what, in essence, I believe is so important about the way this community has evolved and needs to continue to evolve in the future.
Eagle One? going once, going twice. He's had a little bit of communications issue. Let me wait. I think we have him here. Eagle One,
I'm
right
here.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
I'm here.
Your question.
Sorry, Admiral. One of the people in the chat room has asked a pretty good question about the difference between public affairs and strategic communications, and I guess that I'm looking at that from the perspective. It must be a huge issue to try and for you all in the public affairs world to try and explain the Navy mission without coming across as a corporate flax, if you will. Can you kind of discuss the difference between public affairs and strategic communications?
Yeah. strategic communication, I think it means a lot of things to many people. And I can tell you I'm not now and never have been a fan of the phrase, and I'm not now and never have been a fan of the forced artificial process by which strategic communications has tried to subsist inside the military. I think it started back around 04, 05 when the war in Iraq was not going very well, and there was a belief that we weren't doing a good job as an organization communicating at a higher level of understanding, and we weren't pulling together all the communication activities of a military to include psychological operations and information operations, even deception to some point, and pulling it all together as one coalesced effort. And so what eventually ended up happening was, in my view, to a dangerous degree in some of the services, was the subjugation of public affairs underneath all those other efforts. So layered into all that, the belief was, well, PAOs are too reactive. They're not active. They don't get out in front of things. So let's just subjugate the effort underneath the operational IO effort and kind of put it in there, because it is just another arm of communications. Well, it's not. It is not at all. And by doctrine, public affairs should report directly to the commander and should be responsible, in my view, for providing the commander a sanity check on some of the decisions he or she is about to make, and being able to put those decisions in context and in English so that people can understand it. And so strategic communications was meant to be this umbrella effort, if you will. But I think two things have come out of that. One, I think we've all seen the fallacy of that, because strategic communications, in my view, and I know there are people that don't share this opinion, I believe it has utterly failed. And frankly, it should have utterly failed as an effort, as an artificial effort to manage information. And number two, that public affairs needs to remain, as it always has been by doctrine, as a direct report to the commander, not just to do, as you put it, to be corporate flax, but to be good corporate counselors. There are three words that I stress to the entire public affairs community, and by this I don't just mean the officers, but the enlisted and civilians. So we have 2,500 of those professionals in the Navy, and these three words are my three watchwords: it's content, context, and counsel. We provide content. We need to, you know, to generate stories about what your Navy's doing with your tax dollars. Number two, we provide context to the press and to the inquiring public who want to know and understand what we're doing a little bit better, more deeper than the content. And number three, we provide good counsel and advice to our commanders, to our bosses, on how not only to speak about issues, but how to think about those issues.
I was lucky a few years ago. I shared an office with a German Army major who had the nice little yellow stripe around his epaulets, meaning he was in the communications world. His specialty was PSYOPs. And most conversations took place with him and either his counterpart in the U.S. Army or U.S. Air Force. And it's very interesting to see when you would get the info ops, the PSYOPs, and the PAOs together, when we happened to working on Afghanistan at this time, that the national views of the interplay and unfortunately, the Venn diagrams overlap a little bit. And being very careful that you know which circle you're in. Info ops, PSYOPs, or public affairs. And, you know, different nations and different allies have different sensitivities to that. But because there is such a non-existent line between what is going on in theater and what can find its way to the news back in the U.S. on cable, it's very diffuse. There aren't any high lines. You have to be very careful of making sure that the info ops, the psyops, and the public affairs functions don't overlap or interfere, and that you, especially in the public affairs world, you don't find yourself on the wrong side of the equation of whether you're informing, shaping, or influencing. On the U.S. side of the house, just looking nationally, how do you look at how the our Air Force, Army, Navy, and even Marine Corps public affairs communities, how do they work with their counterparts in the info ops and the psyops world? Because it seems the Germans work very close together, but we're a little dysfunctional in some respects.
I don't disagree with your assessment, Sal. I think each of the services view it a little differently, in the Navy, it isn't so much of an issue, because we don't need to, by virtue of naval operations, quite invest in all the legs of those other communication elements as say the Army does. Most joint doctrine, I think, is driven largely by the ground force perspective, and that's not necessarily a bad thing when you look at the last 10 years of war. And I think, you know, having spent a little bit of time in Kabul, and only a little, a couple of months, but also going over to Iraq and Afghanistan much over the last 10 years, I can tell you that it's a constantly evolving sort of relationship between information ops, particularly, and public affairs. And I would say that in general, it's pretty healthy. There are certain commands at certain levels that I think perhaps subjugate public affairs a little bit more than it should be, like I said before. But in general, I think we've grown to take a more healthy view of this. And my view is we need to know, we PAOs, we need to know what the information ops guys are doing and psychological ops and what that is and what they're doing. We've got to have constant awareness. So there has to be some communication between us so that we understand what themes and messages are being pushed and what's out there. But on the other hand, there needs to be a wall that separates those functions very, very clearly, because back to your point about being careful of who you're messaging, the other aspect of this post-audience world that I believe the public lives in, it's not only that they don't just want access to information, but access to conversation. It's that you can't parcel out audiences anymore. You hit on this in your question, and it's a very, very key point. The pervasiveness of information, the ubiquity with which it travels, and the speed at which it travels means it's almost impossible anymore to parcel out your audience and say, well, this is our message to the villagers over here, and this is our message to the larger Afghan population, and this is our message to Congress, and this is our message to the American people. Because once that information's out there, it's out there for everybody to digest. And it makes it much harder for communicators, both public affairs communicators and IO communicators, to dissect the message the way we used to be able to do. You just don't have that luxury anymore. So a relationship with the IO community is important. It just, we all have to realize, they and us, that wall needs to exist. We've got to, when it comes to communicating with the public, that it isn't an influence activity. And I get into this debate all the time with people that think, well, you public affairs officers, you influence whether you like to admit it or not. I say, I'm sorry, I disagree. Can the information we put out cause the influence of opinions and behaviors? Yes, it can, but that's not our driving ambition. That's not our goal. Our goal should be to educate and to inform, and that's where I want the public affairs community focused. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
That works.
Well,
Eagle One.
It was a good answer. I guess one of my questions has to do with gaining and keeping the trust of the people you work with. You've got a commander to deal with, and you've got the press to deal with. Well, how do you balance between keeping the trust of both those sides so you don't end up with a commander who wants to do his own PAO work and something like the 5 o'clock follies, which I remember from my youth, which was a long, long time ago?
Wow, that is a fantastic question. And as you're asking it, all I kept thinking about was that 11 years I spent with Admiral Mullen. I was his PAO from the time he put on 3 stars till he retired as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and I can tell you that this was a man who really understood that dynamic so, so very well. he expected from me, and this is where the PAO is so critical, not just as a communicator, but as a counselor. He expected from me honest, candid, forthright, almost brutal feedback and discussion. And I could have conversations with him in some ways that no other staff member could have, part and parcel because I'd been with him for so long, but also because he understood the importance of the PAO in the decision-making process, not just the communication process. He also had a very healthy appreciation for the role of an independent press. He grew up his father was a publicist in Hollywood, so he grew up in an environment where dealing with the media was the normal course of life, indeed the lifeblood, not only of the family, but of the entertainment industry. So he understood that very, very well. And the sort of the nub of your question would be the word candor. I think he expected me to be candid with him, and he also expected me to be candid with the media to the degree that I could about where he was in his thinking. And so I was often able, without even going to him, to be able to communicate to the press, here's what Chairman Mullen is thinking about the following issue. And I was able to do that because he kept me close. I could go into any meeting if I wanted to, except for only a few very, very highly specialized classified meetings, but I could be with him all the time. So I knew what he was thinking. I could sit and listen as he thought out how he was going to give advice to the secretary or to the president, or how he was going to think himself about an issue perhaps in Iraq or Afghanistan. So there was this mutual candor between us, and he expected me to express that same candor to the media. And he never had engagements with the press without looping me in. I strongly believe that while I think commanders need to have good relationships with the press corps, those relationships need to be fostered through and by the public affairs officers. Now, that doesn't mean we micromanage it. It doesn't mean we prevent our boss from talking. That's not at all what I mean, and I know some of the press corps don't agree with me on this, but I don't mean that the PAO needs to get in the way. It's just that the PAO needs to be a facilitator of that so that everybody in that triad, the press, the principal, and the PAO, have a mutual understanding of what's being said and why.
That's a perfect lead-in to a question I wanted to bring up to you, is that relationship and that candor. I think, you know, especially on personal staff, that's the key to all the best-run staffs I've seen is the senior leader there having his core personal staff, having a degree of candor behind the closed door that's really essential. And when it comes to dealing with the press, and, you know, the press is always very interested in leadership, but it's kind of like how a lot is interested in the wildebeest. And it appears that sometimes people forget about that relationship. And there's a myriad of them, but two of the ones specifically that come to mind is what happened with Admiral Fallon and what happened to General McChrystal, where it seemed to be that there became too much familiarity and maybe a little bit too much access. And on the staffs that I was on that functions real well, there was always a good chief of staff, a good loop, always had the ability to grab the admiral by the elbow, whisper a few things, and kind of redirect back to center line. In the PAO community, what type of ethos is the wrong word I'm looking for, but what type of training can you give as kind of a best practice to help take advantage of, or at least promote a degree of candor where you can help a senior leader who, if they get too close, can really have a national impact when you have a major press blow up, like what happened to Admiral Fallon and General McChrystal?
Right. Well, without getting into the specifics of those two, because I wasn't attached to their staffs, and I certainly don't have all the knowledge of what happened there. But your question does get at a real fundamental sort of chicken and egg phenomenon for PAOs. Is, you know, you have to, in order to be a good counselor to your boss, you have to have a boss that trusts you, and so you have to earn that trust, and the boss needs to want to value candor and frankness, and not all of them do. And so it's this constant do loop that PAOs find themselves in. I can't get close to the boss because the boss won't get close to me, kind of thing. And so we've got to find a way to get at this. I'm trying to attack it from both ends of the spectrum. I'm trying to work on growth and development programs for public affairs officers that encourage them to be that person, that very assertive, aggressive, very frank individual. And that, some of this is a function of personality. Some people are just quieter than others. And at the same time, I'm trying to, in all my dealings with senior leaders in the Navy and before this job across the military, to try to encourage them to seek that kind of counsel, because it really is about protecting the institution, not the boss. As I say to the community as many times as I can, your loyalty is first to the institution, not to your boss. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, particularly coming from a guy who was with a boss for 11 years, but Mullen never expected my first loyalty to be to him. He always expected my first loyalty to be to the institution, whatever that institution was, with the Joint Staff, the military, the Navy, whatever job we were at. If you keep that in your mind, both of you, the PAO and the leader, if you keep that foremost in your mind, you will, by definition, start to make good decisions, and you will be required, if that's your going in assumption, you'll be required to seek that kind of frankness and freshness of ideas, counter opinions. Admiral Mullen was very good at surrounding himself with dissenters. The staff meetings often became very vocal arguments, sometimes right in front of him, and because he wanted us to challenge our own thinking as well as his. And then, of course, he would always, you know, he would make the decision, and he would always stand by the decision he made. But he wanted counter opinions, and he wanted dissenting voices around him. And I think it made for a very healthy atmosphere. Very frustrating at times, I'll be honest with you. But and sometimes it took, you know, a little longer to make a decision maybe than it might have otherwise. But in general, I think it worked, and it always gave him the opportunity to look at all sides and all perspectives before he marched out on something. And I think that's a good place for us all to start, for these staffs. As you talked about, having a good loop and a good chief of staff, yes, they should be good at time management, but they should also be good, all of them, not just the PAO, all of them good at going in and saying, hey, boss, what the heck are you thinking? Why are you doing it this way? Let me tell you how we did it here, or let me tell you here's another way to look at it. Or, you know what, boss? Here's somebody who's really smart. You don't even know this person. Let's bring them in for lunch. Let them tell you what their perspective is, because they've written a book on it, or they've traveled the world about it, or you name it. It's about opening yourself up to other perspectives.
Well, Admiral Kirby, I want to thank you for taking your time this afternoon to talk to us. And before I let you go, is there any super secret PAO plan of attack for the near future you'd like to raise right now?
No, not at all. In fact, there's nothing super secret about PAO. That's exactly what we're trying to avoid. I'm very pleased to be in this job. I'm very honored by this opportunity. The Navy public affairs community is in fantastic health. They're wonderful, very, very talented. I know I couldn't compete with the young officers in the community that we have now, you know, going back to my days as a lieutenant. I'm just pleased to be here, very proud of it, and I'm looking forward to the next 2.5 years in the job. And thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I've enjoyed it greatly.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yes, sir, Admiral Kirby, thank you very much for coming with us this Sunday, and we look forward to following you as we go forward.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much.
And now we'll go on to our second half of the show. And our guest for the second half of the show is returning to us for his second time here with us at MidRats, Major Peter J. Munson, United States Marine Corps. He is the editor of Small Wars Journal, Middle East expert. Is he also the author of an upcoming book, War, Welfare, and Democracy, Rethinking America's Quest for the End of History. It's a sobering view of how we got to where we are and the underlying trends that will impact the global system and America's place in it for the next half century or so. Peter, welcome back to MidRats.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's really good to be back talking to you guys.
Peter, I tell you what, I was having a conversation with one of the gentlemen that's in our chat room here, and he and I were bouncing around because I had recently got through with a book on George Kennan. And, you know, who are the big thinkers of today, and how do you gather one of them? And I'm not saying you're the next George Kennan or anything, but you are somebody who I really do enjoy reading, because your ideas are a bit disruptive. And it's good to bring in lots of different ideas as you're trying to figure out where we're headed to. And that's one thing that I liked about the title of your book, the main title, War, Welfare, and Democracy, because there's quite a few books out there on war and democracy. There's quite a few who talk about welfare and democracy, but you've managed to tie war, welfare, and democracy together in your book. How do you bring those three things together, and what is the underlying message or theme that, that the reader will find in your book?
Okay, well, you know, one of the, I guess the main reason why I bring those three things together is, and I argue, you know, kind of from the outset, that we need to have a broader aperture. We need to be looking, you know, more holistically at problems. We have a lot of folks who specialize and really drill down into, you know, very narrow academic specialization, or if they're practitioners, they practice in a very narrow field. You know, with the increase of technology and the you know, the advance of science and scholarship, that's understandable in one way, but in another way, it makes us look at things a little too narrow and maybe a little bit myopically. So, in this book, I'm arguing primarily that the the world is changing as it always does, but I think we're going undergoing a very epochal change, as I term it, in that we've got very rapidly changing conditions in the developing world, and some of those massive populations in the developing world going through a very quick economic advance, which is shifting wealth from relatively from west to east. At the same time, in the United States and some of the other advanced democracies, the European countries, the welfare state model, which I talk about in some detail, and this is not to be confused with, you know, just the narrow welfare. You know, as we talk about welfare in the United States, you know, welfare handouts, I'm talking about the whole thing to include, you know, schooling, Social Security, you know, how the state cares for the society or provides a safety net for the society. That model is coming into crisis because we've got populations that are aging and in some cases shrinking, and where we had four or five workers, where we had a large number of workers per dependent person, whether elderly or young, now we're getting to a point where that ratio is dwindling. So we've got less workers per dependent person, and that is really going to make a massive change for the welfare state system. And that's one of the underlying drivers that's causing some of the acrimony you see today. So when we understand that there's going to be serious political problems in trying to resolve that, serious economic problems in trying to get our finances in order in the West, along with very rapid changes in the developing world, you know, when we tie all that together, we can see that for the next, at least half century, we're going to be facing increasing challenges in trying to shape the world around us because the relative power balance is skewing. And so that's something that we need to understand first, and we need to work on trying to get our own house in order first before we're going to be able to really cope with the changes that are coming. If we try to cope with the external changes and don't deal with the internal changes, we're going to end up, we're going to end up having a real problem at home that's going to impair our ability to deal with anything going on abroad.
I think one of the things I saw in your book was you mentioned a kind of a disconnect in the way we seem to have viewed the world, where you could put 100,000 troops someplace, hold an election, and declare a victory for democracy. But your indication is that that's not the right approach, that there has to be some spade work done below that level to set up the conditions for democracy or whatever form of government we can live with in some other state, which may or may not be our business. Can you kind of go over that a little bit?
Yes. And the way that I explain that is by looking back at the history of state formation in the West. looking at folks like Fukuyama and his latest book, The Origins of Political Order, Charles Tilly, and some folks like that. States in the West started off, you know, very long time ago, essentially as, you know, warlords that become feudal lords, that become kings, that become despots, that eventually over a long amount of time become democracies. But in that progression, there was a lot of violence, corruption, repression, and there was a lot of identity building, both positive and often quite brutal identity building, where disparate peoples were made into nations. So, you know, we think of France. Well, that's clearly a, you know, some folks would think that that's clearly a geographic entity with a national identity superimposed, you know, together. But France was made up of many different languages, many different tribes. Same with Germany, same with Italy. And if you look a little deeper, you know, behind the popular conceptions, you know, you can quickly see that there's still some fracture lines in all of those countries. But the point being that there's a very long process that led to the relatively vibrant and consensual democracies that we have in the West. And it's, you know, it's crazy to think that, A, we can make that happen very quickly in the, you know, in some of the troubled developing countries today, you know, just by having elections. And B, it's also, I guess, it's wrong-headed to not realize that these countries are facing some of the same problems that all countries or most countries have faced in their history of trying to come to some sort of consensus about who we are, how we want to live, how we want to be governed, and that, of course, there are cultural and historical differences, but this is not as unique as some people would make it seem, and it's not some very unique cultural thing that there's different people, you know, fighting for the way ahead in you know, these countries today. So we really need to just take a longer view, be more patient, and understand that, you know, we can't make these things happen quickly. So there's a choice to be made, which is either we're going to have to let events play out and take a step back, or we're going to have to step deeper in, throw more resources at it, and get involved for the very long run. And I think that's something the American public just isn't interested in today.
That was one part of your book that I really like, being a history geek, is you do point out on quite a few occasions that this desire for intervention really, it's interfering with the natural building process in these developing nations, which the West went through. You know, you just look at what happened, you know, at the time of Queen Elizabeth, her father and her grandfather in France and everywhere else, and even in the British Islands. It takes a while to develop. And you talk about going back to more recent history, something that is part of our character that we seem to forgot, is as a nation, you can decide to be a crusader or an exemplar. In our American tradition, what is the exemplar, what is the crusader, and how does that manifest itself with our nation's relationship to the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, that's a debate that goes back to, you know, the founding of our country. You know, basically once we got our, you know, our independence and began to debate about how we were going to face the world, there were two competing strains of thought. And really, even within a lot of the people in the debate, they had their own internal, internal kind of competition between these two thoughts. Does the United States stand as a city on the hill and be the example for the world, and we try not to entangle ourselves in the, you know, in kind of the problems of the old world and the developing world now, and just act as the exemplar, maybe provide some assistance here and there, but not, you know, not get down in the mud? Or do we go abroad as the crusader, and in order to secure our own way and to secure the way that we want to live, do we have to go abroad to basically strike out, stamp out tyranny wherever it lives, and promote liberal democracy And the strain of thought there is that if we don't do that, you know, if we don't act as the crusader, then eventually that disease of tyranny and illiberalism is going to overcome our own way of life. And this is, you know, this was talked about, you know, in the late 1700s. This was the root of some of the thinking during the Cold War, and you hear the same thing today. I think that, you know, that we have to be honest with ourselves in that, you know, we don't have the means, really, or at least we don't have the will to invest the means that we have in going around the world and trying to crusade for democracy in every corner of the globe. And that the best thing that we can do is to act as the exemplar, to get our own house in order, and to kind of regain some of the, you know, the capital that we had around the world as the, you know, the kind of the shining beacon on the hill, and make sure that, you know, when people around the world see the United States, they think to themselves, that is the way we want to, you know, that is the goal that we're going towards. And right now, with some of the, you know, very acrimonious discourse that we have going on in the United States with the financial problems, and a lot of the things that we've done to ourselves at home, it has very seriously impaired our ability to promote democracy, capitalism, liberal economies, and open markets abroad, because people look at the mess that we're in and say, maybe we don't want to go there. And what that does is help the people that we have labeled either as our enemies or as our competition. It helps them to promote different ways of living that may, in, you know, in the long term, be a threat to us.
Well, that kind of raises an issue which I was thinking about as I was looking through your book about these transnational actors that are not, you know, I mean, we'll take the jihadists as an example. We're not interested in nation states necessarily, but are, you know, their basis for any civilization they want to construct is completely outside the realm of politics and the economic stuff. They're interested in the religious aspect. How do we deal with that from our perspective?
Well, you know, and that comes down to the, you know, the Lexus and the olive tree that Tom Friedman kind of uses to talk about it. And in the book, I mentioned the thymotic drive, which is the thymos, which is part of Fukuyama's argument in The End of History, and that, you know, people aren't just motivated by economics. People are motivated by pride and by, you know, cultural issues, religious issues, and things like that. And so it's, you know, when you face actors like that, it's difficult to come to a, you know, sort of rational accommodation or to, you know, come to some sort of, you know, economic motivation for, you know, peace or reconciliation or what have you. So, you know, that's a very difficult, you know, it's a very difficult thing to unravel. But in my mind, you know, the jihadists are, yes, they're dangerous. Yes, we need to keep our eyes out for them. Yes, we need to go and, you know, potentially, you know, contain and or dismantle their networks where it's possible. But at the same time, you know, if the countries that they're, you know, that they're operating in, you know, the countries that they're operating in are generally going to see that they're really not interested in you know, what those jihadist networks have to offer, and really they only, you know, they're operating where there's ungoverned spaces, and it's not just in Afghanistan, it's, you know, all over, you know, the Africa, and there's actually ungoverned spaces in quotes that they've operated out of in Europe and the United States and in South America. We can't go out and police every ungoverned space. But as far as governed spaces where there's, you know, there's the jihadists are trying to increase their platform, people really aren't going to be interested in that as long as there is an alternative that is providing them some sort of relatively uncorrupt form of government in which the people are able to make some sort of basic subsistence living and in which they don't see the elites robbing them day in and day out. And that's kind of what the Arab Spring has been about. You know, so another big piece of the book is talking about inequality and how, you know, the sense of inequality is one of the things that really drives people to act out against the governments that, that they have, and also helps the jihadists. You know, it's one of their core messages. Look at this corrupt government. If you come with us, we'll give you a better way.
Who are the pigs and the bricks, and how do the differences between those two groups of nations inform us about the near future globally?
Okay, so the pigs, and I may miss a letter here, but there's Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And so the pigs, and I don't remember who coined either of these terms. I think one was by a Goldman Sachs economist, and I can't remember who did the pigs. But the pigs are the kind of the consumer countries in Europe. You know, these are the countries that are in crisis and are you know, really have massive unemployment and are unable to get their economies in order since the financial crisis. The BRICS are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South America is increasingly allied, or I'm sorry, South Africa is increasingly allied with them, and I believe that was coined by Jim O'Neill from Goldman Sachs. So, and really, yeah, those two acronyms are shorthand for, you know, the problems of Europe on one hand, and the potential of the developing, you know, the developing markets on the other. Especially with India and China, we're really seeing those two countries strike out into new markets, trying to establish a foothold in Africa and South America, increase their trade with those countries with an eye to eventually outcompeting, you know, bigger manufacturers and suppliers from Europe and the United States. So as these countries are relatively, well, absolutely and relatively rising in their wealth, you've got Europe who is being dragged down by the poorer economies. And the problem in Europe is that there's a massive structural imbalance between the manufacturing powerhouse of Germany, which is just now kind of coming back out of, it's kind of in and out of recession. Their manufacturing index had been shrinking, and I think it just in the last couple of months it's turned around again. But you know, Germany is definitely the powerhouse of Europe. France, a little bit behind that, even as much as, you know, sometimes we like to bash France and the United States, they're relatively strong industrially. So you've got those and some other northern European countries that are generally in surplus because they're producing, they're manufacturing things and exporting it to southern Europe and to the rest of the world. But then you've got southern Europe that is just, they kind of rode the wave of easy credit from the strength of the euro. They were able to get loans at rates that really didn't match up to the risk that was in their economies. They built up huge speculative bubbles in real estate and other ventures. And when we had the downturn, you know, we began to see that there were no sound fundamentals in those countries. They were in perpetual deficit spending, and they don't have the fundamentals to really get out of it without going into severe austerity. And when you go into severe austerity with unemployment rates that are as much as, you know, 20-25%, your society is really, really hurting. So in Europe, you've got a very slow-motion crisis. A lot of people thought that the euro would fall apart and the EU would fall apart by now. It hasn't. And some people think that they're coming out of the woods, but I'm not so sure about that. So you've got that on the one hand, the rest of the developing world is doing a little bit better. So for the United States, what does that mean? That means that our partners in the world are facing tough times, and I think they're going to be in tough times for quite a while, more than just a couple of years. And at the same time, the rising power in the developing world, especially with, like I said, China and India looking into new markets, We are going to be, we, as far as the United States and its allies, are going to have a lot less power to wield. And so we need to be a lot more critical in how we think about problems and realize that our ability to influence is on the decline.
How much of that is driven, you know, we look at problems, how much of the problems that we see, we seem to get sucked into situations. I'll go back to Somalia, Yugoslavia's breakup, some of these situations, Libya recently, where it may not really be in our national interest to be involved, but we get involved anyway because we're the richest and biggest dog on the block. What happens if we actually said occasionally, no, we're not going to play in that? Where would the world go then?
Well, you know, I think that we have actually said that we're not going to play. I don't want to get too deep into, you know, commenting on, you know, ongoing crises, but, you know, Syria, we haven't gotten involved yet. We've kind of stepped back and let that situation develop for good or for bad. And, you know, the world is kind of accepting that. You know, there is some outcry that, you know, something must be done, but really no one's stepping up to take the mantle there either. In Africa, we've seen, you know, France step into Mali, and we've stepped in a bit of a supporting role, I think, to help them out. We don't necessarily need to be at the forefront of every effort. You know, another example is Libya, where, you know, it was a NATO-led, really European-led effort that the United States supported. And so I don't think it's a terrible thing for us to take, you know, take a step back and to encourage regional partners to do what they can to try to deal with some of these some of these tough situations. Where things will get a little bit stickier is when we start seeing our potential competitors or foes stepping in and really taking core, taking a part in issues that are in our core interests. You know, if we let something in the, you know, in the heart of the Gulf, a crisis there kind of boil over, and then in, you know, 5-10 years time, the Chinese moved in and helped to quell whatever the crisis was, and then began to win that capital as a partner with those nations, people would be very concerned about that. We're not quite to that point yet, but it's something that we need to look at and balance of where do we get involved, how deeply do we get involved, what promises do we make, and if we don't, then who would we like to see step into the breach, or is it something that we just stand by and wait out?
I want to step back a little bit to something you touched on briefly in your answer a little bit ago, is I think we talk about the difference between neo-utopianism and neo-realism. Your book kind of definitely falls in that neo-realist frame of mind. And when you look at what's going on in Europe and you look at what's happened mostly in the U.S., some will argue that we're just in the middle of watching the collapse of the model of the Western welfare state as it was initially kicked off by Bismarck's Germany, 140 or so years ago. If that's what we're seeing or we're in the middle of, when you look at other nations around and other political models around, other developing nations, if they're looking for a model that is the future if the Western welfare state is falling apart, what nations or combinations of nations are getting close to getting a mixture that might be what we're going to see for the next 140 years?
Well, I know we're short on time, so I think that what we need to do is get back to a sustainable model of the welfare state and make sure that that is the model that other people want to look to. State capitalism, really doesn't give a hoot for its society. That's the biggest competitor. But if we don't get our own house in order, avoid the collapse of the welfare state, and provide a, you know, get back to a model that is compelling and sustainable, then we are going to lose the ideological leadership position to something like state capitalism.
Well, Peter, I really want to thank you for joining us. Tell us what, in addition to this book, which is it out now? Because what I've got is the draft copy of it. And when is it? If it is out, where is it available everywhere? And after this, what else have you got on your plate?
Yes, it's out now. It's available in most Barnes & Nobles, and I'm not sure about some of the other outlets. You can order it from pretty much anywhere on the Internet, Amazon, or any of the other major booksellers. And as far as what I've got going on, I'm going to be leaving the Marine Corps this summer. Not 100% sure where I'm going yet, but I'm excited to, you know, attack a new problem set. And, you know, I definitely like to keep writing and commenting and try to see how I can apply my what I've learned to a new area.
Well, Peter, thanks again for coming on this Saturday, and I wish you the best of luck in the transition. When you leave the Marine Corps, the active duty Marine Corps' loss is going to definitely be somebody else's gain, and we'll be keeping track of you, and we'll be keeping in touch.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Peter.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us. Obviously, we're going to have a best of for the Super Bowl next week. But after that, come join us for another edition of MidRats. And until then, have a great Navy and, in Peter's honor, Marine Corps Day. Cheers.
Hello!